From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we remember saxophonist Frank Morgan. He played beautiful music, but for many years, he was surrounded by the opposite of beauty. He spent 30 years in and out of prison on charges related to his heroin habit. But he kept playing in prison. In fact, he kept performing, too, for inmates and visitors. We'll listen back to an interview and performance recorded in our studio in 1987, just a couple of years after he left prison for good and started his new life. Also, Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein joins us with his list of the 10 best films of 2007. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Frank Morgan, a jazz musician with a beautiful sound and a dramatic story, died last Friday of colon cancer. He would have been 74 this Sunday. We're going to listen back to an interview and performance he recorded for Fresh Air. Morgan spent 30 years in and out of California prisons on charges related to a heroin habit, supported by forging checks and fencing stolen property. As we'll hear later, he not only continued to play in prison, he continued to perform. When he reemerged, he started recording again. In 1988, the jazz critic Francis Davis wrote, "At this point, there is no better saxophonist in the bebop idiom." I first spoke with Frank Morgan in August 1987, 2 years after his final release from prison. His parole had recently been lifted, which allowed him to make his first European tour, from which he'd recently returned. He left prison with his playing intact, having performed in prison bands for inmates and visitors. He told me that jazz musicians in prison had a special status.
In a sense, in a small sense, I was like a superstar in prison. People, everyone in the prison knew my name. Everyone mostly came to hear, us when we played, even though everyone wasn't jazz fans. But it's like the only game in town, For a person to go back time after time, like I did, when I could have stayed on the streets and played music and maybe got a chance to see the world, I think that there was a connection that, to me, having found a comfortable place in prison where I was like a superstar when on the streets I was just a small fish in a big pond. In prison, I was a big fish in a small pond.
You spent time in several different prisons. Were you always able to keep your saxophone?
No, there were times when I didn't have it. But most of the time I did. Most of the time it was made convenient. The prison authorities felt that good music helped to keep the prisoners peaceful. And we were used very much in that respect, There were times when the staff would ask us to put on a concert out in the yard if they felt there was a lot of tension. And it was effective.
Well, it must have been a pretty interesting music scene in prison, especially in California prisons, because there was, starting in the 50s, there was really a thriving West Coast jazz scene, and unfortunately, many of the musicians ended up with habits like you did and ended up in prison. Were there a lot of terrific musicians you got to play with while you were incarcerated?
Sure. Not a lot. There wasn't always a great number of good musicians there. But over a period of time, there were a lot of fine musicians that I was in custody with. And sometimes it was as good a band as you could, you'd want to play with on the streets. I mean, in a small, maybe there was enough guys to make up a sextet. of fine players, you know.
Could you practice anytime you wanted to, or were there rules about that?
Sure, there were rules. You know, we couldn't practice in the middle of the night or anything like that, but generally I could practice from any time from 7:30 in the morning until 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, and then we would go to our cells to be counted and to have dinner, and then come back out at 6:30 and stay out until about 10 o'clock. So, you know, we were able to get a good day's music in.
On the outside, jazz has become less of a popular music than it used to be, and it's really funk and rock that are getting played mostly on the radio and that sell the most records and get the most people coming for concerts. And I wonder if a similar thing happened in jail, if jazz became less popular in jail like it did in the outside world.
Well, yes, it did. I think that one of the things that contributed to me deciding to stay out of prison was they're no longer the musicians that play the kind of music that I appreciate. Most of them have gotten smart and are either died or have gotten smart and changed their lifestyle. So I guess the handwriting on the wall was that I no longer needed to be there if I couldn't even play the music.
So it's like a musical generation gap in prison for you.
Yeah, there's a whole different set of things happening that I no longer feel that I can relate to. The prisons and the people have become more violent, and being a nonviolent person, I don't need to be there. I mean, it's bad enough being in a free society with all the violence going on, but I think I need to be where I have some other options, you know.
The last time you got out, in 1985,
yes.
You must have really felt like you were on display, because everybody was watching you. Everyone wanted to hear how you sounded, and also people wanted to see if you could stay straight or not. I mean, I think, let's face it, when a really well-respected musician who had a habit gets out of jail, people want to know, can he make it this time? Was that a lot of pressure for you to be under, being musically tested and almost drug tested at the same time?
Oh, yes. It's still a pressure situation, but isn't life itself, you know, a pressure situation? It's certainly no more pressure than I had upon me trying to get together $1,500 a day, you know, to supply, you know, to buy the dope that I felt that I needed. You know, I have a set of problems now that are entirely different from the ones I had before. As an example, I mean, you know, now I have to maybe decide which agent to sign with, or which record company to enter into an agreement with. I like these problems a lot better, you know.
When you get out of prison on drug-related charges, are there people who hang around and try to tempt you back onto drugs? People who figure that you're vulnerable and they could make some money off of you?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I was a very good customer. I mean, I spent a lot of money. I didn't really cause a dealer a lot of problems. If I went to someone's house, I tried to be respectful of their family or, you know, or whatever their situation was. Sure, so people don't want to really give that up. But God willing, that's not going to happen. I've spent, you know, enough money sending some dope dealers' kids to college, and I'm not sorry for it. I enjoyed what I did. I did it with gusto, you know, if you will. I did it until I completely got tired of it, and that's enough.
I think there's a real intensity in your playing now, and it makes me think about all the years you were in prison when probably one of the few real pleasures you had, maybe I'm wrong, was playing, because your freedom was taken away, but your instrument wasn't, and you could still play. And maybe that kept a certain intensity to your playing.
I certainly acknowledge the fact that in prison, the instrument was the thing that kept me sane, if you will, and the chance to play it, you know, kept me with hope. And now I have a chance to play it and to play it with fine musicians and go home, you know, after I play it. And have a nice home to go to, you know, with a nice piano and a beautiful partner to share life with. And I think that the intensity is just really starting, you know, because I really intend to play and to play my heart out.
Saxophonist Frank Morgan recorded in 1987. He died Friday. One of Morgan's fans is the detective novelist Michael Connelly. The audio version of Connelly's novel, The Overlook, features music by Frank Morgan. The reading is by the actor Len Cariou, who starred in the original Broadway production of Sweeney Todd.
The call came at midnight. Harry Bosch was awakened sitting in the living room in the dark. He liked to think that he was doing this because it allowed him to hear the saxophone better. By masking one of the senses, he accentuated another. But deep down, he knew the truth. He was waiting. The call was from Larry Gandel, his supervisor in Homicide Special. It was Bosch's first call out in the new job, and it was what he had been waiting for.
Harry, you up?
I'm up.
Who's that you got playing?
Frank Morgan, live at Jazz Standard in New York. That's George Cables you're hearing now on piano.
Sounds like all blues.
You nailed it.
Good stuff. I hate to take you away from it.
Bosch used the remote to turn the music off. What's the call, Lieutenant?
That's an excerpt of the audiobook version of The Overlook by Michael Connelly. We'll continue our tribute to saxophonist Frank Morgan after a break. This is Fresh Air.
We're remembering the saxophonist Frank Morgan. He died Friday of colon cancer just over a week before his 74th birthday. In December 1987, just a few months after my first interview with Morgan, we invited him to our studio for a live performance. From that performance, here he is playing Charlie Parker's Now's the Time. Ronnie Matthews is at the piano, Walter Booker on bass. Frank Morgan's 1987 Fresh Air concert gave me a second opportunity to talk with him.
You're in the East Coast on a set of performances that's wrapping up now, and just a few days ago you were performing in a show written by George Trow of the New Yorker magazine based on your life. You were playing the role of yourself and performing on alto in it as well. The show is called Prison Made Tuxedos. What is that a reference to? Where does the title come from?
Well, the title comes from an actual thing that happened in San Quentin. I mean, on a weekly basis. Many of us that were in prison there that played music were in a band known as the Warden's Band, simply because we played on a show that was the Warden's show that showcased many musicians and jugglers and dancers and even some artists that paint were on the show. Every Saturday night, either 1,500 to 2,000 people would come into San Quentin on the warden's invitation to tour the prison, see the gas chamber. You know, most people really wanted to see the gas chamber, I think. I think initially that was the case. Also, I think what developed was a lot of people decided that they would come back time after time to see whether Art Pepper was back or whether I was back or whether Frank Butler was back, so that the music was kind of the musicians that, you know, kind of were on a rotating basis. So I think the people in the Bay Area got a chance to kind of say to themselves, wow, well, let's go over to San Quentin this night, you know, this Saturday night, because Art Pepper's back, you know, or Frank Morgan is back, or Frank Butler is back, or, you know, any number of
people treated it like a club.
Yeah, I'm saying Frank Butler and Art Pepper, because they've gone to the other side, you know, may they rest in peace and God bless them, you know. Rather than name the names of any people that are still alive, you know.
Did you used to perform in that band in tuxedos that were made in prison?
Yes, they were made in prison. They were dyed black from the original denim, blue denim material that we wore on a daily basis. They took them and dyed them black and got some bow ties. And the shoes that we wore were also black. You have to understand that San Quentin is a maximum security prison. So a tuxedo or anything that could be viewed as a suit was a very, very high security risk. And we could never keep them in our cells. It wasn't, you know. The shoes were taken away from inmates that had someone in the shoe factory to make them some personal shoes. And they used to confiscate these from the inmates and then give them to us to wear on the warden show, take them back from us after the show was over.
On your new album of duets, you play the theme from the movie Love Story. But I was interested to read on the liner notes that this was something that you read in prison. It's a song you play beautifully, and I have to say it's a song that I'd really never taken very seriously myself, but you put so much heart into it. You play it so beautifully. You learned it in prison. What were the circumstances behind learning it? I was actually surprised to hear that.
Love Story, I saw the movie Love Story in prison, and I wanted to play the song. And it was a beautiful song, but I didn't want to play it in prison. Because at the time I saw the movie, there wasn't the kind of sensitive musicians in prison to play it with, number one. But it's kind of the thing that I wouldn't want to play unless I was free. So now when I play Love Story, it's my freedom. It's also a song that I play to my grandmother, who was buried in Milwaukee, that was asking for me on her deathbed when I was in San Quentin, and needless to say, they didn't allow me to go. And so when I had the chance last year, I went to Milwaukee for a family reunion, and I went to my grandmother's grave, and I played Love Story.
Really?
For her. And so every time I play it, it's for her.
Frank Morgan recorded in December 1987. He died Friday of colon cancer, just about a week before his 74th birthday. We'll close our remembrance with the song he was just talking about, the theme from the film Love Story. This recording features McCoy Tyner on piano. It's from Morgan's album Major Changes. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the Irish rock film Once on DVD Tuesday. From the families who own Cabot Creamery, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar since 1919, recipes and health tips are at CabotCheese.com. And from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Ship of Ghosts, the story of the USS Houston by James Hornfisher. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our film critic David Edelstein talks about his top 10 list for 2007, and as you can guess from the music, Sweeney Todd made the list. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. So what were your favorite movies this year? You might want to compare your list with the top 10 list our film critic David Edelstein has brought with him. Hi, David. Well, let's start with the 10 best list. Why don't you just like read us through the list, and then we'll talk about some of your entries on it and some of the movies that didn't make it and why.
Well, Terry, other critics have 10 best lists. Mine goes to 11 because it's one louder, isn't it?
Sure.
So here are my 11 films. One of them is a tie. The Diving Bell and the Butterfly was my favorite film of the year, followed very closely by Away From Her, There Will Be Blood, Sweeney Todd, The Savages, No Country for Old Men, No End in Sight, the documentary, Michael Clayton. Here's my tie, and it's very clever because they're both animated. Ratatouille and Persepolis. They're animated, but they're nothing alike. And finally, a small film that is just opened in some markets called Grace is Gone.
Okay, so the number one list on the list is The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is Julian Schnabel's film about a man who becomes paralyzed and communicates by, what, blinking one eye?
Yes, he one eye, I believe he can see through, but there's a danger that it's going to fill up with some pus-like substance and cause various amputations, so they sew it shut. One of the most interesting shots in the film is of that eye being sewn shut from the point of view of the eye.
I have to say, it sounds like it has to be among the more depressing films ever made, but you say it's not.
Well, no, because while it's going on, you hear the voice of the narrator, Jean-Dominique Bauby. The thing is, he's had this massive stroke. He has something now called locked-in syndrome. His mind is fully functional. If anything, it seems to be hyperactive. And yet his body, all he can do is blink one eye. So there's this enormous disconnect between the body and the mind. So one of the clever things about the film is that we hear his voice, and his voice is lucid and funny and sexy. And it's a total shock when a third of the way into the movie, we see what he actually looks like. And what he looks like is, as he says, something out of a jar of formaldehyde. And the fact that he's talking the whole time, that he's making fun of his doctors, or that he's lusting after his therapists, it gives the film a much different quality than your normal illness of the week movie.
Now, Sweeney Todd is number four on your list, and this is the adaptation of the absolutely brilliant, truly wonderful Stephen Sondheim musical. It is directed by Tim Burton, and it stars Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter, both of whom really aren't singers. And this is just probably the most challenging, like musically challenging Broadway musical ever written.
Well, hang on. I have to disagree with you right there. I mean, the most music, this is not Carousel, you know? I mean, sometimes you need real operatic voices. The fact is that, did you see the Michael Cerberus production on Broadway, that great production? Well, Cerberus has a big voice. It's huge, but I wouldn't say that it's beautiful. I mean, I think Sweeney Todd can handle all kinds of voices. What it's never had before in the three times I've seen it on stage in its various Broadway incarnations is actors who have absolutely nothing in the way of pipes. I mean, there's nothing, there's no air. You know, when Johnny Depp is trying to sing about vengeance, he has no air behind it. It's one of those head voices. You know when you hear somebody whose voice is all in their head, you know, sometimes he'll, when he has to sing out, he does that sort of Anthony Newley thing, you know, what kind of fool am I? You know, sorry about that. That sounds worse than he does. But, you know, it's right up there in the head. There's no diaphragm behind it. And that takes a lot of getting used to. But, the movie is great anyway because Burton factors this in and he creates enormous intimacy to the point where most of the time you wouldn't want actors who really sing out, who really, give voices that you could hear, you know, from the third balcony because the camera is so close and because what they're doing is so internal. Johnny Depp gives a very internalized performance. I mean, he looks a fright. He has this sort of streak of white in his hair like Humphrey Bogart had in this old vampire movie that The Return of Dr. X. And he's very silly looking, but he's very, very intense. And Burton actually manages to make Helena Bonham Carter's character kind of sexy in her ghoulish way.
Now, two of the movies on your top 10 list have to do with Iraq. One is the documentary No End in Sight about how he got into Iraq. And the other is Grace is Gone, which stars John Cusack as a father whose wife is in the military and gets killed in Iraq, and he's left with having to tell the children and carry on without their mother. There's been several other movies about Iraq that came out this year, documentaries and feature films. You want to talk a little bit about how Iraq has been playing in the movies and how those movies have been playing with audiences?
A Mighty Heart, Redemption, In the Valley of Ella, Lions for Lambs, Redacted, and they all bombed. They all bombed, and none of them was particularly good. The fact is that Hollywood has never been particularly responsible to national crises. I mean, not since the 60s, which was a very different culture. And I think it was an extraordinary thing that these movies came out this year, that actually Hollywood, or in the case of Redacted, Mark Cuban at HDNet was willing to put money behind these things because there wasn't a very good chance they would do well. They didn't do well. They tended to be very crudely melodramatic or didactic. As for the two movies that I mentioned, No End in Sight is a documentary. It is a documentary, though not from a kind of Michael Moore liberal tub-thumping perspective, but from the perspective of a policy wonk. Charlie Ferguson, who actually studied, you know, day by day what went wrong, the decisions, of course, the key decision being to essentially disband the entire Iraqi army, thereby, you know, liberating all these people who had who now had these enormous chips on their shoulders and access to weapons. And it just looks at that decision by decision by decision. And in the end, your head is swimming. You just can't believe how so many wrong turns were made, whatever your politics, whatever you think of you know, the initial rationale for invading Iraq. Now, Grace is Gone looks at it merely from the home front and from the perspective of a guy who was in the military, who had to leave the military because of his eyesight, whose wife stayed in the military, whose wife dies, and he has to break the news to his two daughters, and he can't do it. And the movie is about his denial, but it's a very loving denial. I don't know. I came out of there feeling like I needed to be wheeled out of that movie.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine, David Edelstein. We'll talk more about his favorite films and performances of the year after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air's film critic, David Edelstein, who's also a film critic for New York Magazine. And we're going through some of his best films of the year and looking at the year in movies. And we should say that some of the movies on your 10 best list haven't opened in most of the country. So if you're hearing a movie that is unfamiliar to you, it's probably because it hasn't opened in your neighborhood yet. But you know, a lot of these movies open first in New York and L.A., particularly this time of year for Academy Award consideration.
Yeah, everything is dominated by, that's why your head will swim if you open the pages of the New York Times Arts and Leisure section or something, and you see all the movies opening, and you think, how can anybody, you know, see all these movies? But in fact, they're only opening to qualify and to be in the heads of critics and Academy voters.
So some of us will have to wait for January to see some of the movies that are on your 10 best list.
That's correct. That's correct. Although some of them are, you know, Away From Her is already on DVD. Mm-hmm. There Will Be Blood and Sweeney Todd open on the 21st. The Savages is open in most of the country. No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film, is open in most of the country. And that, by the way, has been sweeping a lot of the critics' prizes, surprisingly.
Surprising to me.
Well, it's not a crowd pleaser. It's a very, very bleak and bleak film. It might be the ultimate nihilist statement in modern cinema. And so far as it ends on a note of complete and utter resignation.
Is it just me? But somehow the movie seems a little on the surface to me that it seems to degenerate into a chase film with an occasional existential voiceover by Tommy Lee Jones.
Well, it is a chase film, and I think it's a very exciting chase film. It's at the end when the chase all of a sudden stops and the detective, the sheriff, leaves the field and says, "Oh well, evil exists. Nothing you can do about it. Let's go home and pull the covers over our head." That's when I think a lot of people are brought up short. But that, of course, is very true to Cormac McCarthy's vision. My problems are more with Cormac McCarthy's vision than with the film that the Coens have made of it.
David, when you look at your 10 best, or I should say 11 best list, do you see any patterns emerging in the year?
I see sub-patterns. I see little sub-themes emerging. On Away From Her, The Savages and The Diving Bell and the Butterfly all deal with extremely incapacitated people. One of them has Alzheimer's. One of them is the parent of the Savage children who has growing dementia. The other obviously has this massive stroke, and I do think it reflects a lot of our concern, a lot of our anxiety about this mind-body disjunction. As healthcare improves, as the technology improves, and people's minds move further apart from their bodies, I think there's this enormous anxiety both about our parents and what we can do about them when their physical entity remains, but their minds are somewhere else, and what's going to happen to us in the future when presumably technology will even be more advanced.
And any other patterns you see on the 10 best list?
A lot of blood. Mm-hmm. And a lot of really grim material and a lot of unhappy endings. I think that there is a kind of a miasma in this country right now that is really reflected not just in our independent cinema, but in our commercial cinema. Probably more protagonists die in movies this year than any time since the days of Easy Rider, when, you know, it was really fashionable for the hero to get blown off his bicycle at the end. And I don't know if audiences like it better, but I have seen growing derision for fake happy endings. I feel like audiences have become, maybe they don't want to see the heroes die. Maybe that makes them very sad. But at the same time, they're savvy enough now to see that oftentimes a story needs to end with the hero's sacrifice.
Are there movies this year that you think your critic colleagues overpraised and you're in a minority on?
Oh, yes, but they're movies that you admire for trying to do things that other movies never dare to do. I'm not in love with either I'm Not There or Juno. Juno is a real critic's darling at the moment, and of course it will make a great star, and deservedly so, of the young Canadian actress Ellen Page. I found the movie show-offy and fake. I found Juno herself about as real as one of those giant flying robots in Transformers. There's a great idea at the core. It's about a girl who's grown up too fast. And in the course of the film, she connects with a 30-something guy who's trying to stay young. And that screws up his marriage. And it makes her realize that she has to grow up and take more responsibility. And that part is really interesting and affecting. I just found the movie such a hustle in the use of pop songs, in the use of pop culture references, in the almost insanely hyperbolic, clever dialogue. Everybody talked the same, as in really bad Neil Simon. But of course, a lot of people have looked beyond that and are very, very moved and enchanted by the film. The other one, of course, is I'm Not There, Todd Haynes' film, which splits Bob Dylan into all these different personae, I think 7 different ones. And it tries to say that the secret of his greatness is a kind of what Keats called negative capability, an ability to transcend the self or to change the self. But scene by scene, the movie isn't very surprising, except for Cate Blanchett, who sort of plays Dylan as Chuck Barris. That's an amusing stunt, but if you've seen the D.A. Pennebaker documentary, Don't Look Back, you've seen it all before.
What were some of your biggest disappointments this year? Maybe the two films you just talked about, Juno and I'm Not There, fit that description, but are there movies that you were really looking forward to and then felt let down when you saw them?
I guess I was a little disappointed that Redacted caricatured the personalities of the soldiers who committed this atrocity. I felt like De Palma did not have enough of a sympathetic rapport with those characters so that we could look at them and say, that could be me there. That failure of empathy, I think, really cost the movie. As for, I was very excited about The Golden Compass, which I thought was going to be a more sophisticated, more enlightened Lord of the Rings, based on having read the books of Philip Pullman. And it's a disaster. It's really crummy. The first act is bewildering and boring. And because it's not properly set up, the picture that follows has absolutely no oomph. You don't know what the relationship is of people and their demons. It takes a long time to explain. And so when you get to Acts 2 and 3, forget about it. It's chaos. It's so badly staged. And of course, you have these fundamentalist critics saying, well, see, this just proves that you know, if you write a sort of anti-Christian allegory, which, by the way, this is not, you are not going to have an audience in this country. Well, you're not going to have an audience in this country because you made a really crummy movie.
Well, that reminds me. How much do you think the culture wars were played out in the movie theaters this year?
The culture war didn't play out in a lot of movies because people didn't see a lot of the movies in which they would have played out. I think where you most saw an impact was in the area of abortion. Knocked Up, for example, was a movie about a woman and a man who are wildly unsuitable, who have a one-night stand. Neither one of them is in a position to have a child, to support a child, to create a stable family environment for a child, and yet the heroine decides to go ahead and have the baby and gives extremely what many people saw as short shrift to the idea of terminating the pregnancy. And that's the same thing that happens in Juno. And if you see Lake of Fire, the Tony Kaye documentary that documents the abortion movement, well, Tony Kaye says that he's being neutral in the film, but he does show you an entire abortion from beginning to end. And simply by putting the abortion clinics into the movies, simply by showing these graphic images in the films, I think many of them are able to create, you know, enormously powerful statements about why one should not terminate a pregnancy.
Do you think that Juno and Knocked Up are making anti-abortion statements, or do you think that they're just comic premises for movies? Or not so comic, but, you know, premises for movies.
I think that anything you do in a film is going to have political ramifications. I think the decision of the character in Knocked Up to bear the child is inexplicable. Now, that's completely independent of whatever I think about abortion. I'm saying about on its own terms, the decision is ludicrous, and it's made more so by Judd Apatow, the writer-director. He simply throws in every possible reason why this woman should not bear a child. He makes the case extremely efficiently, and then he wipes it out with her ringing assertion that she's going to bear the child no matter what. That's a political statement. Whether you agree with it or not, it's a political statement.
My guest is Fresh Air's film critic and film critic for New York Magazine, David Edelstein. We'll talk more about his favorite films and performances of the year after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fresh Air film critic David Edelstein. We're looking back on the year in film. What are some of your favorite performances of the year?
There were so many amazing performances this year. I'm delighted that Frank Langella has finally gotten a spotlight. In the small film Starting Out in the Evening, he plays an aging white novelist, kind of a Saul Bellow figure, who but neglected. And he's at work on a new book, and a graduate student played by Lauren Ambrose comes to do a dissertation on him and possibly to seduce him. And he's such a big, sad, hulking figure. He gives a very immobile performance. It's all in his eyes and in that deep voice. And he's lived for so long below the surface of his life that you're afraid what happens if this girl actually does seduce him and bring him to the surface, and whether or not he has the strength to handle it, either physically or emotionally. It's a stunning performance by a man who I think we've overlooked for many years. I mean, certainly since his Dracula was the last time he got any attention. And he was fantastic as William Paley in Good Night and Good Luck, and in Frost Nixon, which is soon to be a movie.
I want to throw in a couple of good words for two performances this year. One is Viggo Mortensen in Eastern Promises. I thought he was just really terrific in that. And Casey Affleck was awfully good in Gone Baby Gone, which is on your extended your extended list of the best films of the year. And he was also really good in The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. I hope I got that right. It's such a long title.
I think you did. It was a lovely performance, too. The best thing about Viggo Mortensen as an actor is that he can maintain this sort of very amused surface and signal that there's all kinds of things going on in his head. You'll never really get to the bottom of it. He's a great person to cast as a character who you're not sure is a good guy or a bad guy.
David, how is the TV writer's strike affecting the movie world?
Well, I think it's going to affect the television world much more because the studios have been stockpiling scripts. So there's no shortage of scripts to make. Where it comes up in Hollywood is if a script needs work. And it's not ready to go before the camera or an actor says, I can't do that right now. It needs a rewrite. And are you going to be able to entice someone for enough money to cross the picket line or to do it in secret? I know that that has happened in the past, I know. I hope it doesn't happen here. There is a film right now called State of Play, which is based on a wonderful BBC miniseries that is being remade here. I know that Brad Pitt left the cast because he wasn't satisfied with the part he was playing. Russell Crowe stepped in. I think the filmmakers got a good deal in that particular regard. But the question is, are they going to go ahead and shoot if the original writer can't do a rewrite or they can't hire one of these fabulously expensive rewrite people to do it?
So is the problem that the original writer is in the guild that's striking?
That's correct. Now, I had a friend.
So there's a lot of people who do both. They write for television, they write for movies, and if their guild is striking, they can't write for movies.
Oh, it's the TV writers and the film writers are in this together. Both of them stand to lose massive amounts of money once the business shifts to direct downloading and moves to the internet. I had a friend who I won't name who wrote a blockbuster and was asked to rewrite it during the last writer's strike. He chose not to do it. Someone from England came in and did it, very, very hush-hush. And he's bitter about it to this day, and I don't blame him. The script is weaker for it.
So the TV writers and the screenwriters are in the same guild, but I thought it was just the TV writers who were on strike.
No, it's the film writers too.
Oh, you know, I didn't really understand that. So this means like all screenplays are basically on hold right now?
Well, as I said, the studios were stockpiling. I mean, television stockpiled a lot of scripts too. I mean, I know TV writers who you know spent many sleepless nights trying to get their scripts done before the inevitable strike came. But yes, it's much easier when you have a film script than it is when you have an ongoing, an endlessly demanding television series.
Well, one more question for you, David. If you were to recommend one movie for people to see over the holidays, and a movie that will have opened widely by Christmas, what would it be?
I would say go see Sweeney Todd, but be prepared for a lot of arterial spray. Great music, great photography, great performances, amazing arterial spray of all sorts. You've never seen anything like this blood on a essentially black-white charcoal canvas. It just leaps out of the screen. It's so audacious. You know that Tim Burton is just cackling. And at the same time, you're swooning because the music is so beautiful.
Well, David, I want to wish you happy holidays. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
And to you, Terry. Thank you.
David Edelstein is the film critic for Fresh Air and New York Magazine. You can find his list of the best films of the year on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, Patty Leswing, and Jonathan Menjivar. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with music from Sweeney Todd.
Mrs. Lovett, you're a bloody wonder, eminently practical and yet appropriate as always. As you've said repeatedly, there's little point in dwelling on the past. Now come here,
everything
my love.
Everything you did, I swear, I thought was only
not
for the best.
Not a thing to fear, my love. What's dead is dead.
Still be married.
There is still mystery of the world, my pet.
Oh, Mr. Todd, leave it to me.
Is learn forgiveness and try to forget.
By the same Mr. Todd will become very cozy. By the same Mr. Todd where there's no one knows
and
him.
And life is for the alive, my dear. So let's keep living it.
Just keep living it.
Really living it.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director Paul Thomas Anderson talks about his new film, There Will Be Blood, starring Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man in the early days of the oil industry and Paul Dano as a boy preacher. They each claim to have the power to transform people's lives, one through oil money, one through God. Join us for the next Fresh Air.